10 years ago, today's guest added to his distinguished publishing career by writing a New York Times bestseller. The book, The Secret History of the World, became somewhat famous because it claimed to reveal for the first time the secrets behind the world's secret societies.
Bloodline. Roseline.
Curious as to what some of the secrets Mark Booth discovered?
I think there are different orders of angels. I think that they need us. I think that we have free will because we are inside physical bodies. And I think that there is also another side. There are evil forces waiting to step in if we let our mind go down a certain path.
That's right. Angels, demons, and all that other stuff that we kind of suspect is somehow or another really out there. Not out there like this. Tom Hanks, Hollywood, bullets in the Vatican from the movie Angels and Demons. But is out there in a way that unfortunately doesn't resolve itself in 2 hours and 26 minutes, which was way too long for that movie. Oh, and in case you're worried, I let Mark off the hook regarding tough questions. Awesome on one level, a little bit too much Oxford philosopher on the other level, because I bring it down to like, let's talk about current events. What do we think about the current Pope? A little bit too much association with known pedophiles for my liking. What are we to do with that? So we can process it as in the spirit of what you were saying before of, hey, this is part of the plan. Or we can process it from another way. I know you don't like to go the conspiratorial angle, but you know, this is something that's been in play for a while, it seems like, in culture as a way to kind of debase culture, as a way to kind of shape culture in a way that maybe we don't understand. What are we to make of the pedo pope?
I think that kind of churchy Christianity has served its purpose. I think it's decadent now. I go to Ireland quite a lot to visit my visionary friend, Lorna Byrne. Ireland is not a religious country anymore. The paedophile priests, they've turned that nation off Christianity.
Stick around. My chat with Mark Booth is coming up on Skeptico. Today we welcome Mark Booth to Skeptico. Mark is probably best known as the author of The Secret History of the World, an international bestseller from 2008 that really, and I don't think this is at all an exaggeration, it changed the way we think and talk about esoteric wisdom, secret societies, mystery schools. And it was also a book, I think, that has played a part in weakening the grip of this kind of soul-crushing scientific materialism that we talk about so much on this show. Mark, it's great to have you here. Thanks so much for joining me.
Well, I'm so pleased to be on your show. I admire it enormously. And I admire your cast of mind. You know, you're curious about everything, but you don't want to be stupid. And you know, I think if there is a God, he doesn't want us to be stupid. So that's a very sensible attitude to take.
Right on to that. And in that spirit, you know, I really want to have what I like to call a level three kind of discussion here. Because, you know, level one is, as our culture would say, why would you listen to Mark Booth? I mean, that's just ridiculous. Don't even pay any attention. And then level two is the people who just admire and so greatly are inspired by your work, as they should be, and say, yes, we must believe everything that Mark says. And then it's level three that we don't have enough of, where it says, gee, this is a wonderful dialogue to engage in. And here is someone who I truly believe is a hero to have stepped forward and fight these tremendous cultural forces that you just have stacked yourself against. But let's dig into it a little bit further. So anyways, that's my speech. That's where we're going to go. So if at any time you think I'm poking you too hard, let me know. But we need to have that next level of discussion. So Mark, one of the reasons that you're joining us today is that you're just releasing, and I have it on pre-order, this beautiful edition, The Illustrated Sacred History of the World. Now, I have to tell you, my plan is to put this thing right out front and center in the coffee table and hope that those beautiful artwork and illustrations will entice people in, and then I can use it as the litmus test to kind of bang them over the head and say, okay, now let's get going. So do you think my plan has any chance of working? Is it gonna work with the illustration and the artwork?
Well, there's some, I mean, I've had a wonderful time choosing illustrations to go in it. It kind of plays into this new edition, plays into what I wanted to do with the book all along, which is that I wanted to write a book which gave an account of an esoteric account of the history of the world, but it didn't try to prove any of it. To try to prove any of the elements in it would take an entire library of books. But what I wanted to do was to tell a story and have philosophical truths unfold out of that story. It's a sort of French way of writing. When I was at school, I used to love reading the novels of Sartre or Voltaire's Candide. It's a kind of French style of writing. There's not a lot of it in English literature. I don't think there's a huge amount in American literature either. So what I wanted to do was to try to engage people in a complete imaginative vision in the hope that it would resonate with them. And some people would read it and say, yes, you know, that's the way I experience the world. And it does cohere. It is cogent. It is a consistent account of human experience. So yeah, I think having very beautiful pictures is going to help in that side of the enterprise.
Yeah, because isn't that really what art is about? I mean, no one would look at a great piece of art and say, you know, that's not literally true, because the way they portrayed the curvature of the arm isn't the way that it really is. I mean, it's both. I mean, it's both can be taken on so many different levels simultaneously. So what are the parallels there?
Yeah, well, I suppose it depends on what you mean by real and true and literal. And what you mean by those phrases probably has a lot to do with what your particular individual form of consciousness is. I mean, I think that we tend to live by a polite fiction, a convenient fiction, that we all share the same form of consciousness. But in fact, I think there's a huge variety. In fact, I think there's a sort of spectrum. You know, at one end of the scale, you'll get the militant atheists, the materialists, and they're very kind of their personality type is. They're very down to earth. They're very analytical. They're very sense oriented. And I think at the other end of the spectrum, you probably get people who are more intuitive, who might a bit more dreamy, who regularly have premonitions and other intuitions that turn out to be true. At the far end of the scale, you get people like my friend Lorna Byrne, who sees angels all her working hours. And I guess that if you take great, you know, some of the great painters like Leonardo da Vinci or Raphael or Dürer or Bosch who were included in this book, they will tend to be more down towards the lawner end of the spectrum, I think.
Before we get too far into it, let's talk a little bit about your bio. We should let people know. One of the things I think is interesting on a number of levels. One is that you're a super smart guy. I mean, you went to Oxford and studied philosophy and theology and then came back and taught it and all the rest of that stuff. But then, you know, you have this really impressive career in publishing, and you're kind of the triple threat. You're the editor, publisher, writer, and at a very high level with, you know, names that anyone would recognize, and people who are familiar with this show would recognize: Rupert Sheldrake, Graham Hancock, Whitley Strieber, as we were just talking about a little bit ago, the Dalai Lama. I mean, the list goes on and on. Tell us a little bit about that bio so people know kind of who you are in this world that you come from, where you've been incredibly successful and accomplished.
Well, that's very sweet of you to say so. So when I was a child living in Cambridge, I sometimes used to have what I would now call mystical experiences. And I remember on one occasion being in my bedroom and being filled with light and information, a massive amount of it. And I filled up an entire school exercise book with drawings and ravings. And then I used to go and walk in the countryside near where I lived. And I remember having a sense of the presence of other beings and other forms of consciousness. And I suppose as I grew older, I naturally became more curious about that. And I suppose it was probably those anomalous experiences which didn't fit in at all to the materialist worldview, which was then and still is very much the establishment worldview. I think that's probably what led me to study philosophy and theology. And I found that the philosophy ate up all the theology, in the sense that the philosophy was very analytical. We certainly weren't allowed to discuss philosophy of life questions at Oxford. That didn't count as philosophy at all. You know, I was told if you mention Sartre in your finals, you'll fail, just on that point. And I found that I began to question these experiences I've had began to question any religious belief I might have had. And the philosophy at the time was very corrosive. And the philosophy at the time was saying language about religious experiences isn't even meaningful. And I felt quite oppressed by all of that. I felt that the kind of mystical experiences were receding, and so I started to take LSD as a way of trying to pull some of that back, and it worked. I think it worked, and I think that has informed my work. I noticed that a lot of people who enjoy my work have taken a lot of hallucinogenic drugs, and I think that, I think it's certainly the case that hallucinogenic drugs can help people to tune into other dimensions and spiritual realms, which are, in a very important sense, real.
You know, one thing I'm curious about is, as a professional, you know, you're entering into the workforce and you're trying to make a living, and you wind up being very successful at that. I want to say, despite your interest in these kind of other unconventional kind of thinking? Or did that actually help you because there became a wave of popularity in those books? But I guess I'm also interested in, as your career has gone on, what has it been like? You've really gone off reservation here, right, Mark? I mean, I can't imagine that a lot of the publishing industry is inviting you to a lot of, you can kind of go against the grain here in terms of a lot of the cultural memes and themes that are being promoted.
Yeah, well, I think I found when I left university that a degree in philosophy and theology made me almost completely unemployable. And I eventually drifted into book selling, and then I had a tremendously lucky break in that a guy said to me, well, if you put together a proposal for a list I like, I'll finance it. So I went from having no experience to having my own list. And so I moved into general commercial fiction and nonfiction. But I you know, I still had an interest in that area, and I was trying to sneak titles in all the time. And then I did have a few successes. You know, I mean, you mentioned Graham Hancock. There was a time when Graham Hancock and Robert Bovall were bombing up and down the bestseller lists, and I worked with Colin Wilson and Robert Lomas, The Hiram Key. I don't know if that book is well known in the States. It's a book about the Freemasonic mysteries. A brilliant book, actually. I really recommend that book and that author. So yeah, I was allowed to get away with these crazy, incomprehensible books. And then something very interesting happened, because I suppose I kind of got a bit of a name in those sort of circles. It's something that I touch on at the beginning of the Secret History of the World. A guy came to see me who I could tell there was something a bit different about him. He had a completely different aura. He had a business proposal, which is that there were the various ancient alchemical texts, and he said, I want you to republish these, and I will write a new introduction to them. And I thought, well, I'm never going to be able to persuade my bosses to let me do that. But anyway, I immediately took to him. We went to lunch, and that was the beginning of a very firm friendship. And I learned that he was an initiate of several secret societies, one of them at a very high level. And because we were firm friends, he kind of allowed me to ask him questions. And occasionally he would say, I'm not permitted to tell you that. But a lot of the time he would tell me. And so all these things I'd been reading about, I'd been reading a lot of Rudolf Steiner and Gurdjieff, because I had a magus for a friend, I could ask him to explain the bits that I couldn't understand. And gradually it all began to take shape in my head. And so that felt like providence, that meeting.
Yes, maybe. But you know, there's another angle to look at it from as well. You write in the book, esoteric thinking has always sought to undermine and subvert conventional, habitual, and mechanical modes of thought. And I wonder, as you're saying that, if we take the providence part out of it for a minute and set it aside, I wonder if we could take that further. Do you think this dogmatic rationalism, this you are a biological robot in a meaningless universe meme, so step up and get chipped and do what you're told. Do you think that that has been engineered into our culture, or do you think that's just grown organically out of the discoveries we've made?
I think there's a bit of both, but I think that there is a third factor, which is that it was meant to be. I talk about secret societies in my books, but in another way, my books are to be set against conspiracy theory books, because the I do touch on the dark side, and I know people love to talk about that. I think it's dangerous to dwell on it too much. And so the main thrust of my books really is talking about sacred societies and sacred individuals who are pursuing a plan which is good. And I think that it's always been part of the plan that humanity should go through this phase of being deeply materialistic, because I think that we are learning something from that. In the Reformation, when the images of angels and demons were smashed in churches, and a lot of Catholic flim-flam were swept away, this was an attempt to try to diminish a dreamy, visionary form of consciousness. And it's no accident that that smashing of the idols happened in England, and that it was in England that the scientific and industrial revolution began. Because in order for that to happen, people had to develop a capacity for abstract intellectual thought that wouldn't be possible while we still had that old visionary form of consciousness. And of course, we've lost a huge amount, and we need to regain it, I think, but using that conceptual form of intelligence which we have now. We are well on the way to developing
it. Awesome. And challenging at the same part. It brings us to this kind of level three discussion, because your book, The Secret History of the World, and the new book, The Illustrated Secret History of the World, is absolutely loved and cherished by thousands and thousands of people for a lot of the reasons that you just said right there, in terms of being a visionary kind of total mind shift in the way we understand what's going on around our world. But at the same time, it's come under fire from a lot of camps. People don't like it for this reason or that reason, or it steps on this group's toes. This group of Rosicrucians say you haven't dealt with that, or this group of Gnostics say you've kind of given us a shorthand. But there's two things I want to touch on and get your thoughts on. You've kind of addressed them, but not really. One is the footnote thing. Now, in the back of your book, you have an awesome list of the books you've used as source material, and it's certainly impressive, but the book itself has no footnotes. And I guess I just juxtapose that with the kind of discussions that I've had on this show, because I've gotten into, for whatever reason, because this is how I like to do things, but these deep discussions about biblical history and guys arguing about the shape of a Greek letter and how that should be translated and all the rest of that stuff. And on one hand, you can say, gee, does any of that stuff matter? And could we even understand it in terms of this consensus reality that you're talking about? But on the other hand, how would we ever know unless we're willing to take these little shards of data, as we call them, and try and get to the bottom of things? So how do you respond to critics who say, Mark, there's too much opinion and mixed in, and where are the footnotes, Mark? Where is the proof of this? And not just proof, because proof takes us in the wrong direction. where is the way to critically examine the other points of view that come with some of the things that you're saying?
Well, I think, as I say, I wanted people to read The Secret History of the World as a story. And I think that footnotes would have distracted from that. I think to have any value at all, the footnotes would needed to have been at least as long as the book itself. I had a very strict limit of the number of words I could use from my publisher, and so I think I'm quite happy with it as it is. My second book, The Sacred History, which examines many of the same ideas, that does have extensive footnotes, and then some people want footnotes to the footnotes. My aim was just was really that people would read that and say, yes, that is the world I live in.
Let me throw an example on the table just so we give some meat to what we're talking about from the book. According to esoteric Christianity, Jesus Christ lived on earth in the middle of the history of the cosmos. His life represents the great turning point in history. Everything after it mirrors what happened beforehand. Okay, so good enough, but is this now you saying this? Do you believe that Jesus was a historical figure and that his birth was a great turning point or the great turning point in history? Is this Mark now talking, or is this just one of many different viewpoints on how we would understand this?
Well, that's a central tenet of esoteric Christianity. So that
sure.
You will find that view expounded in the Rosicrucian stream, for which the leading writer in the 20th century in that stream by a long way was Rudolf Steiner.
But is this what you believe?
Yes,
it is. I'm totally okay with that. I'm also okay with challenging that on any number of levels. You know, one guy I've really enjoyed having on the show was a guy named Joseph Atwell, who's a biblical scholar and is is of the mythicist kind of camp, although he comes at it from a different angle. But when I have those guys on, and I've had a number of them on, both Christian scholars who are Christians and Christian scholars who are not Christian, and at the end of the day, there's a lot to sort through there in terms of our history. Like one of the things that Joseph Atwell brings to the table is a new understanding of Josephus. And it's just hard to argue against the evidence that he mounts that Josephus was available or accessed by gospel writers, which completely undermines a lot of the gospels.
Does it though? Does it? I don't think it does. Why does it undermine it?
Well, it certainly undermines the prophetic. I mean, if I'm sitting there with a historical account and I'm writing prophecy, it just undermines my credibility. So if I'm Luke and I'm writing prophecy, and at the same time I have a historical account, which I can later show was kind of an invention in and of itself because we're not so sure that Josephus really lived like he said. We don't really have any historical account of that. The whole thing starts...
No. And we also think that some of the references to Jesus may have been later interpolations, don't we?
Completely. So what kind of ground are we standing on here as the sand starts to slip in one direction or another, and then...
I don't think the sand is slipping. I think, as I say in the book, there is almost nothing in the life and sayings of Jesus that wasn't done or said before. And I think that there was, there was a great, there's a kind of great coming together of these sources. And you could look at the life and sayings of Jesus Christ, a complete patchwork of previous historical documents, or you could say that this was the cosmos straining to give birth to these great events.
Or rebirth, or that,
yeah.
Yes, but then for the literalist, it makes it hard to see it as, what is it again? The great turning point in history. I mean, another great turning point, maybe, but the great turning point in history, it just riles a lot of us who have kind of sought to understand these things from a broader perspective than just a very narrow, strictly Christian perspective. I know that's not exactly where you're coming from, but again, that's why I'm saying I want to have this level three discussion that just doesn't dismiss things in one way or another, because I think what you're saying is really quite important. But
And this is absolutely isn't to denigrate the other world religions or spiritual traditions, but I think that there is something new and unique happened with the life of Jesus, and that was the beginning of the interior life. He planted a seed there, and that's not something that you find in the other religions.
Buddha didn't do that 500 years before.
No.
He wasn't exploring the interior.
He wasn't exploring the individual interior life.
Why not? In what way was he not?
He was creating the conditions for that, but he didn't give rise to the individualism that came out of Jesus and Christianity, and which flourished in the West.
Okay,
that's
fair enough. Okay, I mean, we don't have to agree on all this stuff exactly. It's just good to get it out there.
I do understand that your reaction against churchy Christianity and.
What do you think my reaction is? Because I think most people don't understand my reaction. A lot of people listen to the show and think that I'm anti-Christian or something like that. Because again, we never get to the second part of it for me, which is that whatever one believes about the historical Jesus, you can look no further than the near-death experience, for example, to get proof positive from scientific means, if you want to use that term, that Christ consciousness is not only alive, but is a powerful force that completely transforms lives. So to me, it leaves the question of how are we to reconcile the historical account of Jesus with the ultimate reality of Christ consciousness. But it seems like whenever I get into these discussions, it always winds up digressing to, you know, my belief that the historical account of Jesus is undermined by just a lot of good archaeological and biblical scholarship. It just kind of crumbles in some important ways. But again, I don't know how we have that discussion. That's probably, you know, a 5-hour discussion, not a 30-minute discussion.
My guess is, I can't speak for you, but my guess would be that your problem with churchy Christianity is partly that it's dogmatic, partly that it's patriarchal, authoritarian, it's hierarchical, it's very masculist. A lot of bad things have been done in Jesus' name. I was reading the other day a book by the Jewish scholar Martin Buber, and he wrote an excellent book about the Baal Shem Tov, this extraordinary Jewish mystic. And Martin Buber, who I am sure, having just read this book, is Bob Dylan's, that it is where Bob Dylan got the imagery for All Along the Watchtower and all that extraordinary apocalyptic imagery he uses, particularly in those early songs. But Martin Buber says dogma, teaching, he says there are two streams in Judaism. There is dogma and teaching, and that only gives you a partial truth. Myth gives you the whole truth. And I think that the same dichotomy that he's talking about in Judaism, you can also see in Christianity. I think that the myth is this beautiful, living, growing, shifting, evolving thing, multidimensional. And then there's church dogma, which most people can't relate to at all. I mean, who cares about the Trinity? Nobody cares about the Trinity. That's just a waste of people's intellectual time. But there is still, you know, there is still great spiritual nourishment you can find in the Gospels and the Epistles. You know, there are some mind-blowing statements there.
Sure. You know, that doesn't really get at my problem with the Christian worldview, but it's interesting because to me that's the level one cesspool debate that we get into with, you know, the angry atheist who's saying, you know, if God exists, why are these children dying? Which is interesting on one level, but on another level kind of misses the point. I guess my problem with it is that it doesn't seem to answer fully my questions about what we know, what we're discovering about extended consciousness realms. So, you know, you mentioned your experiences with LSD. Well, there's a host of experiences and that people have brought back and told us about what those realms look like. Similarly, with near-death experience, people have told us what those afterlife realms look like. And then we can go over in the esoteric magic traditions and they can tell us one thing, or I can talk as I am next month to a woman who's going to do a past life regression. And I've done that in the past, but we're going to do it again and we're going to kind of deconstruct it. So there's all these different viewpoints about this extended consciousness, which is, again, this level three, getting past the idiocy of the, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Joe Rogan, oh, it's all bullshit kind of thing, and then kind of looking at it more deeply. And I just don't see where Christianity, for the most part, in the general sense, is willing to embrace that in a way of saying, okay, let's look at all that stuff and try and make it make sense to us in terms of answering the questions about how we should live our lives, you know?
Mm. Well, I think that if you're saying that you would expect to find answers to questions about LSD experience and after-death experiences in the Bible, that's a little unfair. I mean, I think that really the Christianity is part of an evolving dialogue, which involves the other religions and the other mystical traditions and traditions which are outside all organized religion, and it's not a static thing. It's evolving. Also, partly because the spiritual realms themselves are evolving. I mean, I think, as one of the things I write in the book, I think there's a very good reason why people's accounts of what happened after death in Old Testament times are very different from accounts of what happened in medieval times. And that's because the other realms evolve just as ours does.
Awesome on one level, a little bit too much Oxford philosopher on the other level. But because I bring it down to, like, let's talk about current events. What do we think about the current Pope? A little bit too much association with known pedophiles for my liking. What are we to do with that? So we can process it as, in the spirit of what you were saying before, of, hey, this is part of the plan. Or we can process it from another way. I know you don't like to go the conspiratorial angle, but, you know, this is something that's been in play for a while, it seems like, in culture as a way to kind of debase culture, as a way to kind of shape culture in a way that maybe we don't understand. What are we to make of the pedo pope?
I think that kind of churchy Christianity has served its purpose. I think it's decadent now. I go to Ireland quite a lot to visit my visionary friend Lorna Byrne. Ireland is not a religious country anymore. The paedophile priests, they've they've turned that nation off Christianity. You know, the church is being punished for all of that, as it should be. I'm not going to defend that.
Part of the plan? Part of the plan, or something we should actively...
No, it's outlived its usefulness. And of course, I'm not saying we should actively fight it. And of course, I'm not saying that there aren't evil conspiracies. Of course, there are cabals of mostly old men who get together and plot to do things for their own advantage that they shouldn't do. Of course that goes on. I mean, my publishing work, you know, I've met guys from the special forces and also spooks, and you know, a lot of the time the worst thing you could possibly imagine them doing, they are in fact doing.
Let me probe that for a minute. How do you map that evil? If we stare into the abyss and agree that we're not going to stare too long, and that the secret of the ascent is to look up and to be positive and to enliven us with light. But if we look into the abyss for a moment, what do you make of the nature of that evil? Where is it coming from? I like how you divide it up. We have the spooks, the people who are doing things who maybe their intention or their belief system is that they're doing it for good, if you will. We also have people who are doing it for evil, who have just an evil intent and have somehow absorbed that into their kind of belief system. How do you process that?
I mean, I have to say that sometimes I think that spooks and special forces are working to prevent bombs going off in our city centres on both sides of the Atlantic. So that's for the good. Where you have something that the French are particularly guilty of is using espionage services to secret services to promote commercial interests. I think, you know, that is wrong. Where you have groups of powerful men, be they priests or politicians or businessmen, being sexually exploitative of children and others, that is awful, and that is evil. That is an influx of evil operating in the world.
Right. You know, one thing I guess I kind of toy around with is the topology of these extended realms, both the good and the bad. What is it looking like? Is there a hierarchy? I know you believe in God, so you believe in a hierarchy. What's your best guess as to some of the topological features of these extended realms?
I think there are different orders of angels. I think that they need us. I think that we have free will because we are inside physical bodies, and our access to higher realms and God is limited and filtered. I think that these angels don't have free will in the same way that we do. I think that they create the conditions which make life possible. I think they find it quite hard to influence physical events, but they are adept at moving minds. And I think that there is also another side. There are evil forces waiting to step in if we let our mind go down a certain path. And I think that's dangerous. I mean, I think that, you know, I worry about people. I know you've discussed in the past on your show practitioners of magic, people who perform magical ceremonies. I kind of worry about that a bit. And I know I'm going to be saying something which is not popular with many of your listeners, but I think that history tends to show that if you practice magic with a view to pursuing selfish ends, if you make an agreement with the kind of forces that are going to help you to achieve those ends, things are probably not going to go too well with you. And I think that people who do that have a very limited view of what the spiritual realms are. They see it as they see the spiritual realms as being like a sort of shadowy penumbra around human beings. They don't see it extending all the way up to God.
I would agree fundamentally with what you're saying, with a couple of caveats. I mean, I think the important thing that the magical community has brought forward in a positive way is to help us understand that this interaction we have with the spiritual world, with the spirit world, is in play and should be taken seriously and not merely defined from one particular viewpoint. Because I think a lot of times Christians are quick to dismiss all this talk and not realize that they're practicing magic, right? So if you're if you're a Christian and you're praying to the Virgin Mary, where is that coming from? You're praying to, you know, a spirit that you think can have influence in this world. So totally with what you're saying, but also want to acknowledge the important contribution that I think the magical community makes there. I think you are completely right. And as I've said on this show many times, I think it's the hierarchy is the key to follow there. And I think the data takes us there. Just taking the data that we know in terms of like near-death experience, out-of-body experience, all this different knowledge of after-death communication. Everyone says there's a hierarchy, right? So we can look past that and say, well, I don't believe there's a hierarchy. There's just this kind of amorphous blob of consciousness, and you can do what thou wilt, you know, Crowleyism kind of thing. It's like the data doesn't support that, so I don't know where you're coming from.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
Mark, what's next for you? What are you working on currently? What other projects would you like to do that you maybe haven't had a chance to do?
Well, one of the things I'm most excited about that I can talk about is that I'm working with Pete Townsend of The Who, and he's a deeply spiritual guy, and he's written a novel that is more autobiographical than his autobiography. And that talks about his spiritual journey, and that's also going to be his third rock opera after. So I hope that we'll be publishing the book of that next year. There are also some very exciting developments on a coming together of science and spirituality. I think it's going to change people's minds a lot. And I think that, you know, we're reaching a stage now where, particularly in Silicon Valley, where science and engineering, is reaching such a high level that it can begin to understand the hierarchy from a scientific viewpoint. There are some amazing scientists out there. I mean, what pisses me off is that the people like Richard Dawkins and the militant atheists, the materialists, they don't know what's going on in science. You know, they believe in a model of science which was discredited 20 years ago.
I believe they're there for a purpose. I think they're serving a purpose for certain people who want to influence culture in a certain way. And I don't want to get super hyper conspiratorial, because as you said, that leads you down just some silliness. But on the other hand, I think to suppose that people who have power and influence are choosing not to exercise that power and influence in a certain particular way to get what they want is incredibly naive. Of course, if you have the money, if you have the power, if you have the influence, you're going to use it to get what you want. And I think Dawkins represents that. Let me ask a question related to that Silicon Valley thing and the AI thing, which is very prominent now. What do you make of this idea that we're living in a matrix-like reality, or that AI is something, strong AI is something that we should if not fear, be very cautious of, because it could penetrate these extended realms that we're talking about. What do you think about that?
I think there is a danger in that. I did a couple of books a few years ago with a leading developer of artificial intelligence, Kevin Warwick. And one of the things he was doing was implanting microchips in his body and then also in his wife's body. The effect of that was that he did some experiments. He found that if he had a pain, his wife could feel the pain. You take it the next step. He has an emotion. His wife has an emotion. He has an image in his head. His wife has that image. That could go a long way to being very similar to the sorts of abilities that very spiritual people have. I think that is a danger. And I think that, you know, technologies being developed in Silicon Valley to download human consciousness so that it achieves immortality in that way. Well, how does that sit if your soul and spirit have left the body and and they want to be, they want eternal life in a natural way? You know, I think there are dangers in that.
There's certainly questions, aren't there? I mean, it has the potential of redefining our understanding of spirituality and soul. And I wonder if your work, the body of your work, speaks not only to the dangers of that, but the reality of that. Do you believe personally that such a technological transformation would lead to a genuine spiritual transformation, or are we looking at a counterfeited spirituality in some of this stuff?
I think there's a great danger of that counterfeit spirituality. I think the problem is at the moment that, you know, with some notable exceptions like Rupert Sheldrake, who you mentioned earlier, science is in the hands of militant atheists. And I think that, you know, a lot of them would really like, as I'm not sure it's a kind of big conspiracy, but as a matter of temperamental preference, they would just like to see all spirit squeezed out of the cosmos. And that is a danger. And I think they have performed a sort of trick on us. I think that materialist philosophy, materialist science has performed a trick on us, which is that we think that it's unreasonable to believe, to hold spiritual beliefs. And that's just a trick. You see, you could take a question. I wanted to ask you a question. I wanted to ask you a question which the scientific community would say there is one obvious answer to. Can we just try a little experiment and see if you think you'll be able to tell what the answer is they want you to give? But just tell me if you think this is the right one. Is it more plausible that all the matter in the universe organized itself along intelligent lines sometime after the beginning of the universe? Or is it more likely that this intelligence was already inherent in it in the beginning?
I think that's a trick question, but I definitely think that intelligence, I think, permeates everything in the form of consciousness. So I'm with you in terms of idealism, and it just seems to me that the way the data falls, it's consciousness first, matter second, which kind of makes the whole thing kind of an upside down question.
Well, that's interesting, because more and more scientists, cosmologists, are moving towards panpsychism, which is that view.
Which is the poor man's idealism for folks who are still for folks who are still are not willing to make the leap, you know, where they have a resting stone along the river there.
Can I ask you another question? If the universe is a self-organizing structure, what do we mean by self?
Yes.
Is human intelligence a freak accident in a dead universe, or a natural growth in a living universe?
These are great questions. You know, a couple of years ago, I wrote a book, and Rupert actually wrote the foreword to it. It was called Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything.
Fantastic.
And the premise of the book, which Rupert, he was super sweet to write the foreword, but he had to say, I have to kind of back off of this a little bit because I still have to have some legitimacy in the scientific community. But the premise was, if you get consciousness wrong, which science has, there's no question. They've just gotten it wrong in terms of science being an epiphenomenon of the brain. That's just out of the question now. So it's just been proven. So if you get that wrong, it's hard to get anything right. So I think you could, you know, you could generate 1,000 questions like this, and the answer to all of them is the same. It's like, until you get the consciousness question correct, you're just looking through the wrong end of the telescope here, and it doesn't make make a lot of sense.
Yeah. You see, I think that Richard Dawkins would say he would tell you that the answers to those three questions, there was an obvious choice in each one, but I think any reasonable person dwelling on those questions a little while could see it's not obvious. It's not obvious which is the right choice.
I love the way you put that. So our guest again has been very excellent, Mark Booth, and the book that you're going to want to add to your Christmas list, seriously, and maybe the wish list of some other folks in your life who need a little worldview expansion, The Illustrated Secret History of the World. Well, it's been absolutely awesome having you on, Mark. Thanks again so much for joining me.
Enjoyed it so much. Thank you, Alex.
Thanks again to Mark Booth for joining me today on Skeptico. You know, I had an interesting brief email exchange with Mark after the show, and it's interesting on a couple of fronts that will come up later in future Skeptico shows. But one thing that I always get from Christians is they say, you seem troubled by the question of Jesus being a historical figure. And that always gets me. It's like, no, I'm not troubled. I just don't know why you're not troubled. I mean, you're a Christian. You should be really troubled about whether it's true or not. I mean, if it's anything other than a slam dunk, and if you've listened to this show, you know that the history of Jesus is not a slam dunk, then you're really the one that should be troubled. I mean, you got to find a way to figure that out. Now, in Mark's case, and I give him a ton of credit, he's moved the dialogue much further in kind of taking this thought form, mythical consensus reality, idealism, Christ consciousness thing that I always talk about in this word salad kind of way. But I think he's, in my opinion, kind of coming closer to at least putting it together in a way that makes sense. The problem, of course, is that if we are going to have a real dialogue about that, and if we're going to get down and dirty about that, then we do have to subject ourselves to the historical kind of analysis that biblical scholars have done and we've talked about on this show. So Joe Atwell always comes to mind because he's the top dog, in my opinion, right now. And I'm open to anyone coming on and proving otherwise. Welcome it. I not only welcome it, but I actively look for someone to change my mind on that. Because to me, the key to the story is Josephus. And if you're a Christian and you haven't totally grokked Josephus, then you got a little work to do, but once you do, then you come on Skeptico and we'll talk, or I'll bring Joe Atwell back and we'll all talk. But on to the traditional one question that I do. One question from my interview with Mark Booth: does he kind of get the big picture right? We can squabble about the details, but what about the big picture? There are angels, there's demons, there's good, there's bad. We know the difference. We know what we're supposed to do. We know the challenges. We know we're not perfect. But the secret of the ascent, it would seem, is to always look up. Hey, but that isn't much of a question. Let's turn it into one. What do you think? Do I have it right? Does Mark have it right? Does he have it wrong? What's the counter argument to that? And who's going to advance that counter argument on this show? Who would you like to see come on and challenge that idea. Okay, enough analysis there. I never know how much to go into. I mean, sometimes when I listen to a podcast, I don't want anyone to say anything, and I just want it to sit there and have me kind of figure it out. And other times, you know, I think I as a listener, and I hope you as a listener, do want to hear some context and do want to hear some opinion. I mean, otherwise, how are we supposed to all figure this out and form counter opinions unless we hear someone else's opinion at least going first? So, and hey, if you've stuck around this long, 400 episodes or so, you know you're going to get a lot of opinion on this show. Do check out the Skeptico website, SKEPTIKO. Find it wherever you can. Join the forum. Love to chat with people on the forum if you're up for that. And of course, please stick around for future episodes. Until then, take care and bye for now.